From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. On today's show, as Michigan considers whether or not to allow recreational marijuana, we'll take a look at the successes and problems encountered in Colorado.
And what they have found is that they've gone purchased legally marijuana, but they haven't had any places to legally smoke it. So they've had to turn to concentrates and to edibles.
Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody is back from that state, and we're going to get some answers. Then Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes says the economy is roaring right now. But we're going to ask, can that actually last?
I don't think there's any question about what this trade war is going to be or is a headwind on the economy. The question is, how stiff of a headwind is it?
And we are 8 weeks away from election 2018. We're going to break down the governor's race. Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in today for Cynthia Canty. If you can believe it, we are now 2 months from Election Day 2018. That is when Michiganders are going to go to the polls to vote for a new governor. Let's check in on the race as it stands today with Zach Gorchow. He is editor of Gongwer News Service. Hey, Zach.
Hey, Zoe. Good to be with you.
So good to have you. So one of the political issues really making news this week is, of course, health care, specifically Healthy Michigan. That's the extension of the Affordable Care Act, and more than 600,000 Michiganders are covered under it. Now, we've talked before about this, that Republican gubernatorial candidate Bill Schuette seems to not be completely sure even himself of where he stands on the issue of Healthy Michigan. He did talk about it this week, though. Fill us in.
Well, he has been struggling to say for some time what his intentions were with the Healthy Michigan Medicaid expansion program. Sort of sidestepped direct questions about it, but this week he appeared to say for the first time, if he was elected governor, he would not seek to repeal it. And this just really, I think, understates how the ground, or underscores rather, how the ground has shifted on the Affordable Care Act since it was enacted. You recall that, you know, Bill Schuette is one of several attorneys general who tried to have the Affordable Care Act thrown out in court. He's opposed it every step of the way. It was a useful political weapon the Republicans used against Democrats for several years. But now, you know, almost a decade into it, it's become more popular. And really, the Medicaid expansion program, since Michigan enacted it in 2013, has always been popular. And now Schuette is on the defensive because he has, up until this point, made it clear he did not support that program at all and used it as a club against Brian Kelly in the Republican primary.
Right. Yeah, he hit his Republican opponent, Kelly, hard on this in the primary. So now that, you know, he's talking about it in this general election, what is the takeaway for voters? Is it just like hypocrisy, or is it maybe a sincere policy change?
I think the takeaway is he's realized it's a political vulnerability now. And there's a little bit of finger in the wind type activity here that, you know, the Affordable Care Act remains very unpopular in the Republican Party. So he used Brian Kelly's support of Medicaid expansion against him in the primary. But now we're into the general election where, you know, Medicaid expansion is pretty popular. The idea of removing 680,000 some people from their health insurance is not going to go over well, and now he's shifting on that, and you know it doesn't look great for him. I don't think there's any way to argue that somehow he comes off looking good, you know, trying to shift on a dime here.
And it's hard for me to believe that this is going to be, you know, he was on a radio show when he made this latest statement that this is going to be the end of it, right? Like, we're going to have gubernatorial debates, and he's going to get pushed on this.
Yeah, I think you're right. And the Democrats really, right out of the gate after the primary, have been going after Bill Schuette on health care. This has really been a major theme of theirs that, you know, he tried to get, you know, the Affordable Care Act thrown out. Now, they don't use quite those words, but they say things like he would have prevented, you know, pre-existing conditions from being covered or children from being able to stay on their parents' insurance deep into their 20s. Those are provisions, of course, under the Affordable Care Act. Now, he's tried to nuance it and say things like, well, the Affordable Care Act has problems. You know, the insurance exchanges aren't working well. The problem is, you know, those popular provisions are part of the Affordable Care Act, too, so the Democrats can point to those and say he wants to throw those out. And it's a difficult position for him to be in. I mean, he's been a visible foe of the Affordable Care Act for all, you know, almost 8 years of him being attorney general. And up until this point, we hadn't really heard him in a meaningful way say, well, yeah, get rid of the Affordable Care Act, but keep these provisions. That hasn't been an emphasis to this point. You know, maybe he thought that at the time, but it was never, I don't like the Affordable Care Act except for these provisions. That's never been something he's said.
And it's pretty surreal, just as political reporters, I think, who have been covering Schuette since, before even he was attorney general, but during that race, and just how unpopular it is to now be talking about it, that he's on the other side of the issue. I mean, it's just like how the tables have turned. It's pretty fascinating to look at public policy, health policy, and where voters are at. Meanwhile, Democratic candidate Gretchen Whitmer, also on commercial radio earlier this week, she was asked about whether or not she would take an anti-tax pledge. She just straight up said no.
Yeah, she referred to such pledges as being foolish. Bill Schuette has signed the Americans for Tax Reform No Tax Pledge, which means he has pledged he will not do anything to raise taxes. And Gretchen Whitmer has said she will not. And, you know, she was pressed on that and basically said, look, you know, if government isn't doing the things like fixing roads and investing in schools and investing in water infrastructure, people are going to pay for it another way, whether that's higher tuition bills or busted tires and so forth. So there's going to be, I mean, this is sort of your classic philosophical divide. The Republicans have been and are continuing to hammer her for, you know, being likely to propose some type of a tax increase. And Gretchen Whitmer has pretty much said, bring it on. She's not spelling out, I'm going to raise A, B, and C taxes, but she's making it clear that she believes the state has underinvested in key services and infrastructure, and revenue has to be found to do that. So, you know, if she gets elected, then we'll find out what she has in mind.
And what a fascinating just like issue this is when you consider earlier this year, Republicans who control the state house, the Speaker of the House actually put up a vote to completely roll back the income tax here in Michigan, right, to zero. And yet here on the other flip side, we've got a candidate saying, I'm not promising anything. So let's talk a little bit about folks who are actually going to turn out and vote in November. Of course, we will not actually know that until Election Day. But a former Michigan elections director in Michigan, Chris Thomas, who just kind of seems to know everything about everything when it comes to elections because he's been doing it for so long, he actually made a prediction this week that he thinks we could see more than 4 million voters turn out on Election Day. To put that in context, he says typically turnout in a midterm general election is like in the neighborhood of 3.2 million. So could we actually think we could see 800,000 more or even another million more voters turn out during this midterm?
I mean, based on what happened in the primary, it seems very possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, remember, this was the highest primary turnout since those records have been kept going back to 1978 in terms of percentages. You know, it really seems like, you know, there could be this massive, massive turnout. I mean, you're seeing at least on the Democratic side, a huge surge in turnout from the primary. And even in most places, Republican turnout was up too, just nowhere near to the extent of Democrats. So, yeah, I'm not a turnout scientist as far as making predictions, but
I want that to be your title, turnout scientist.
Right, yeah. But, yeah, based on what happened in the primary, it seems very possible.
So speaking of, I want to, you wrote this awesome blog post last week about Midland, and you kind of actually dig into some turnout numbers. Midland, of course, the hometown of Bill Schuette, and you looked at who turned out in the primary. Explain what you found, because it's eye-opening.
Yeah, so Midland County, Bill Schuette's basically lived there his whole life. It's generally known as a Republican bastion. And I compared the turnout in this past August primary to the last midterm primary in August of 2014. And if you look at the participation in the gubernatorial primary, Republican turnout was up, I believe, 15%. I don't have my numbers right in front of me, but I think that's what it was, which you'd say, okay, 15%, sure. You know, went from a primary 4 years ago where there were no contested races to very competitive races this time. Okay, 15%, that makes sense. But on the Democratic side, the primary turnout went up 291%, you know, more than 20 times the increase that was seen on the Republican side. I mean, it was just...
And again, let's remember, this is Midland County that you're talking about specifically.
Right, and to carry that forward, if you looked at the 2010 and 2014 primaries, the previous two primaries for governor, and you looked at the total primary vote in that county, about 82% on average was happening on the Republican side in those two primaries. But this time, that percentage fell to 61%. So you had this huge fall off, and I've looked at this in a number of areas around the state, and that is almost as high a fall off as anywhere else. I mean, it's definitely at the upper echelon of Republican fall off of any area in the state. And this is with Bill Schuette, this is his on the ballot. He's the hometown guy. You would think that maybe he would, be able to mitigate what's happening somewhat around the state with Democratic turnout surging and people saying, well, this is our guy. But that did not happen.
And Zach Gorchuk calls himself not a turnout scientist. Dude. You just totally dissuaded me from using that title ever again. But your actual your actual title, though, of course, is editor of Gongwer News Service. Zach, thanks for your time.
Great to be with you.
Okay, what are you going to be watching for the next 8 weeks now?
Ooh, I mean, I think the next thing to watch is once the absentee ballots start coming in and looking at how that compares to 4 years ago. Is there a huge uptick in certain areas? That's going to be the big thing I'm keen in on, probably starting in 3 weeks.
Well, we're going to have you back in 3 weeks to talk about it then. Bye.
All right.
And still to come on the show, a project exploring the artistic connections between Detroit and Zimbabwe.
Stevie Wonder was the first cultural ambassador to Zimbabwe, and he talked about how Zimbabwe was murdered in the streets of Detroit and the symbolism of Zimbabwe had in Detroit.
That story is coming up in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. This November, Michiganders will vote on whether to allow recreational marijuana in the state. Michigan is at a crossroads, like many other states, when it comes to marijuana policy. Pot is still illegal at the federal level, but public opinion is changing. In fact, more than 60% of Americans now favor legalizing weed. Michigan Radio Steve Carmody just got back from Colorado. That's because that state legalized recreational pot 4 years ago, and he wanted to see what things are like now. Welcome back, Steve.
Oh, thank you.
So we put out a call for questions about the future of marijuana in Michigan ahead of this November vote, and we want to look to you for some answers. But first, let's just get all on the same page. What exactly would this ballot proposal in November mean if it is approved?
Well, basically, on a personal level, what it would mean is you'd be able to possess, if you're over the age of 21, up to 2.5 ounces of marijuana flower or up to 15 grams of marijuana concentrate.
And the ballot language is pretty simple, right? It's like 100 words that voters will read on the ballot.
Exactly. It's 100 words on the ballot, but it's about 5 pages in its totality. So there's a lot there that goes into how the industry would be regulated, what would be allowed, what wouldn't be allowed. So it's a very extensive document, but on the ballot, it's 100 words.
Okay, so let's jump into some questions then related to whether this is, the complications or not. So let's start with Jeff, who wrote, he wants to know, would legalizing recreational use have any effects on the current laws regarding medical marijuana?
The proposal doesn't make any changes to Michigan's existing medical marijuana laws, but it is worth noting that there have been issues in other states that have involved increasing prices and decreasing access for certain strains of marijuana that medicinal patients rely on.
Okay. Josh wants to know, are there current plans to regulate marijuana use in public areas, similar to that of alcohol or smoking?
Well, consumption would be illegal in public places, as well as, of course, driving under the influence. And in places like Colorado, where I just was, that's been a bit of an issue because a lot of consumers have been tourists to the state of Colorado. And what they have found is that they've gone purchased legally marijuana, but they haven't had any places to legally smoke it. So they've had to turn to concentrates and to edibles.
Okay. Valerie has a very basic, simple question. Will people be able to grow their own, and then would they be able to sell it?
Well, each household would be allowed to possess up to 12 plants for personal use. The plants would have to be stored in a secure place. They could give up to 2.5 ounces of marijuana flower as a gift, but no, they couldn't sell it.
Okay. Jennifer wants to know, my apartment lease says because marijuana is illegal federally, they do not allow it. And she says medical marijuana, they don't allow either on the property. How or would that change?
Well, this initiative would allow landlords to continue to ban smoking, but they couldn't ban possession or use of cannabis products by means other than smoking. So edibles and concentrates would be allowed, but obviously this is something that probably will end up in the courts.
Let's talk a little bit about some regulations. A listener wants to know, for example, could Oakland County become a dry county? Like, how would that work? And could cities and municipalities choose to opt out?
Well, each community would have the right to determine how it wants to regulate marijuana businesses within its jurisdiction, or they could ban them altogether. And well, and again, that's the way it works right now in Colorado. And the result has been, essentially, people who live in places without retail stores would simply drive to a city or town nearby where sales are allowed.
Okay. And so again, kind of on the regulation side of things, a question from Greg. He asks, can the state overturn the proposal if voters overwhelmingly vote in favor of recreational marijuana in November?
Well, the governor cannot veto the proposal once it's passed. The legislature, though, could amend it or overturn the proposal, but that would take a supermajority in both the House and the Senate, which, given the Michigan legislature, would be very difficult to do.
Okay. So, Steve, as we mentioned, you got back from Colorado. I assume that state grappled with many of these questions that we're trying to answer. What was your takeaway 4 years later for Colorado? What does that portend, do you think, for Michigan if it becomes legal here?
Well, Colorado and other states that have passed recreational adult use have been dealing with problems and continue to deal with issues because, you know, you're talking about taking a product that had been illegal, still is on the federal level, and turning it into a legal industry that needs regulation and needs education. And it's just a very complicated question for those states and for Michigan. So that's why in what I'm doing is I'm looking at several different issues in the reports I'm producing this month, dealing with law enforcement and business, to how a booming retail marijuana industry affects small town life and basically what to tell your kids if this does become law. And there's a lot to digest here. So we'll be sharing a lot of what I've come across online and as well as on air. And I hope that people will take it in and take the time to share their thoughts with us on Twitter and Facebook.
Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody on the Pot Beat. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
So, as you can tell, we love incorporating your questions here on Stateside. So, this is our next call out to you. Chemicals, commonly known as PFAS, are being discovered, as you have likely heard, at more and more sites across the state. If you live near one of these contaminated places, you probably have questions, and we want to hear them and try to answer them for you. So give us a call, 734-764-7840. Just tell us your name, where you live, how long you've been aware of PFAS contamination near you, and then ask your questions. Again, the number is 734-7840. 334-764-7840. You can also send us your questions by going to the stateside page. You can find us at michiganradio.org. Jit is a uniquely Detroit art form. It's a fast-paced dance with intricate footwork that emerged in the 1970s. The dance started in the era of funk, but later became entwined with the city's emerging techno scene. Across the Atlantic, people in Zimbabwe were familiar with a different kind of jit. There, it's a style of popular dance music with deep roots in the country's musical traditions. The Zimbabwe Cultural Center of Detroit is behind a project that brings the two art forms together. Cindy Canty talked to two of the artists involved in the cultural exchange. Cheeto Johnson is a Detroit artist and co-founder of the Zimbabwe Cultural Center of Detroit. Haleem Strings Rasool is a Detroit jit dancer and director of the documentary Jitterbugs, Pioneers of the Jit. Cindy had Haleem start out by describing what Detroit jit looks like.
We got our own intricate footwork where it could be applied to the floor through a drop we call drops. It's like a hitting the floor with exclamation. And we have just our own unique footwork patterns. You know, there, of course, there's footwork and tap and other styles, but we have our own unique way. And some of the terms that we use are kicks, wiggles, crossover, clinches.
And tempo is fast, right?
Tempo is usually fast, but again, this was pre-techno when it started, so it was done to funk, and then it sped up as the music started to change and speed up.
And Cheeto, you grew up in Zimbabwe, you're the son of missionaries there, and as you're growing up there, you're well acquainted with a different kind of jit. Yeah. Tell us about that.
Actually, jit technically is a music too, but in terms of dance, I could just repeat exactly what Haleem said. Same description, different words, but same description. And that was the crazy thing. We had been connected through, we both got a Kresge during the same time, and we were doing a show. And then I saw all these posters up, Jit Workshop. And I was like, oh, Zimbabweans in town. What's going on?
And then you discover, oh, wait, there's Detroit Jit.
Yeah. But removing the sound, the dance is equivalent.
Interesting.
Uncannily.
So what did you think when you realized that there was this whole other world in Detroit?
You know, having been raised and lived here, what's kept me in Detroit was feeling at home outside of home. And there is so many mirrors. Like, especially we're going back to some earlier times. We look at even the 2008, 2009, 2010. You know, there was the media, how it portrayed Detroit was equivalent to how it portrayed Zimbabwe. So you could remove the word Zimbabwe and put Detroit and vice versa. And, you know, history going back to the Pan-Africanist movement, the connection to Zimbabwe. Stevie Wonder was the first cultural ambassador to Zimbabwe. As an artist, he went in 1982 to sing Master Blaster, and he talked about how Zimbabwe was murdered in the streets of Detroit and the symbolism of Zimbabwe had in Detroit at that time in 79, 78. And so there's been existing links that we just clasped on. It pre-existed beyond us. So we were looking at that connection, and we've been doing a lot of connections since that. And this just was a perfect when it just came up, the uncanny relationship of the dance and, yeah.
And Haleem, we're talking about for the Detroit jit. This is this form of dance, as you say, emerged in the late 60s into the 1970s. So how did, and you were not around then, I'm looking at you. How did you get into that? How did it come into your life?
Well, growing up in Detroit and going to school and being around peers, you see this footwork dance that you see at the dances and things like that. You even see it on shows like New Dance Show at the time where I was watching. And you can see some of it on the scene, which was popular in the 70s and going to the 80s. But when you're young like that, you think this is happening all across the world. Mm-hmm. So through my travels, I was in other forms of dance. It made me look back and reflect to, you know, what Detroit is unique in, you know, and that's what started making me double back and ask questions about these things that I only saw in Detroit and nowhere else. And that kind of led me on a path of, like, connecting dots.
Well, speaking of connecting dots, let's listen to a comparison of the kind of music that modern Detroit JIT dancers are dancing to versus some classic JIT from Zimbabwe. So what are the similarities that you hear between these two, and more so how are you merging them with your project, the JIT Exchange?
Well, Zimbabwe Culture Center Detroit was before, with no funding, we were doing mostly virtual exchanges. It was purely through social media and finding a virtual landscape. But fortunately, with the Knights grant, we're able to have physical exchanges of artists from Detroit going to Zimbabwe to do research there and vice versa from Zimbabwe to Detroit. And that's when we approached Halim and be like, oh man, you have to go to Zimbabwe and not only to research JIT there, but also to bring Detroit JIT to Zimbabwe.
And so, Halim, that was what, 6 weeks you spent in Zimbabwe working with musicians and dancers?
Yep, 5-6 weeks, yep.
What was that like for you?
Man, that was my first time over in the continent of Africa, and it was amazing. It was beautiful just being able to have that people-to-people relation and interaction. So just beyond JIT, it was just, you know, going on as a researcher, you know, and being able to share the Detroit style was just... you know, great experience.
What did you see as the main differences and the main similarities?
Well, there's one particular step that's called the Burrowdale that comes from JIT lineage on the Zimbabwe mm-hmm. side. And we have a funk JIT style that we do. And those are kind of similar in pace, almost like the pattern. You know, there's a tempo, you know, the speed of it is similar as well. You know, as far as music, the music is different. Like, you wouldn't really see any, like, relationship as far as, you know, instrumentation and things like that. I know the guitar is dominant in the Zimbabwe side, straight production on the Detroit side, electronic bass. So that's an interesting tidbit.
How did it affect you as an artist, to that 6 weeks of being in Zimbabwe and experiencing that and merging your art with theirs? What did that do for you as an artist?
Inspiration. That's what artists live on, you know what I'm saying? So, and then possibilities. So, like I said, me going over there was the first phase, and, you know, trying to get collaborators from there on this side is just the second. So, and then who knows what the future holds.
And, Chido, I see you're happy because this cultural exchange, this JIT mm-hmm. exchange, it's part of this ongoing mission and this work you're doing. So tell us about some of the other cross-cultural exchanges that you're making happen between Zimbabwe and Detroit.
Yeah, actually, as Halim mentioned, we were hoping to bring the dancers that he had connected there here. But now we're so fortunate that we're doing two phases. We're doing one phase this year to focus on the sonic intersection, being guided by Halim, being conscious of the tempo. But then the second phase next year will be for the dance. We're going to bring the dancers here. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, both Halim talked about the JIT history here at the University of Michigan, as well as Mono Mukundu. And it was amazing to be re-educated about those connections. And seemingly, the music seems so different. We were saying, oh, the dance is just a dance. Strip the music, but wow, that dance is crazy. But Mono's educated us in the history of the JIT music in Zimbabwe, how the tempo coming before the guitar had the same mm-hmm. tempo as the JIT music. That's crazy.
And I know there's a performance happening on Thursday. Halim, tell us what's planned and where it'll be held.
Yeah, so we have a big show. It's going to be at the UMA Museum here at U of M. Everything's going to kick off at 7. We got a good show from front to back, and we have guests. But main collaborators will be myself and Mano Mukundu. And then we even have an alumni here named Everett Reed, which is called E. Reed and the JIT Coalition. And we got some interesting fusion with music and dance. Can't wait.
And right before that, opening at 4:30 at Gallery Das is a collaboration with Elizabeth James, from the DAS program, and that is one of several Zimbabwe Cultural Center projects. This particular project is called I Wish You Here, Postcards Through the Eyes of the Other. And right now, if you go to a town in Mutare by the border of Mozambique and you walk at the gallery there, there's a postcard stand. And you walk in the postcard stand, the postcard stand has buildings or significant streets in the town of Mutare. But when you flip that card around, they're all Detroit artists. And similarly, here in Detroit, you'll see postcards similarly by artists Mutare. So the show at the National Gallery, the main focus is this postcard exchange. So if you show up at a gallery DAS at 4:30, there's some good food, drinks, good art, and then prepare yourself for this amazing performance.
So a very, very rich, rich artistic collaboration. Chido Johnson, Detroit artist and co-founder of the Zimbabwe Cultural Center of Detroit, and Halim Strings Rasul, Detroit chit dancer, founder of the dance group Hardcore Detroit. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The music you heard in this segment was My AUX Mind by Aux 88, followed by Paul Impofu performing Mu Rabinda. Still to come, Kalamazoo's John Fetzer was a broadcast executive and the longtime owner of the Detroit Tigers. But he kept his lifelong New Age and metaphysical beliefs quiet.
I think he was concerned that in Southwest Michigan, which tends to be pretty conservative religiously, that if people knew he was studying all this metaphysical stuff, he'd lose audience members and advertisers.
That story in about 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in today for Cindy Canty. Quote, the economy's roaring, growth is surging, unemployment is near record lows, and President Donald Trump is claiming all the credit. Whatever. That's what Detroit News' Daniel Howes writes in his latest column. Dan, first of all, you're laughing at your own words.
Well, I'm only laughing because I've already got emails this morning about, who do you think deserves credit for it? Not Obama. And as I pointed out to the person, look, the expansion and the recovery started in 2009. Mm-hmm. Anybody who owns any stock in their 401k or 403b or outright knows that the market bottomed out in about, I think, March of 2009, has been climbing pretty much ever since. Now, it is also true to the Trump people out there that the economy's growth rate has accelerated during Trump's term, and particularly in the last year. And the unemployment rate is reaching lows. We heard yesterday from one of the governors of the Fed, approaching numbers we haven't seen since the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. And I am an optimist, but I think there are plenty of folks going, this is too good to be true, waiting for a bubble. And one of the things that you write about is that trade is a source of uncertainty right now.
Yeah, and it was very interesting. I mean, I think for those of us that are covering business and kind of following the auto industry, this is a daily kind of story right now. Mm-hmm. When you have a company like Ford that comes out and says, we're not going to be building cars and selling cars in the United States anymore, except for the Mustang. Oh, but we're going to put this, we're going to take this Focus Active that has been the crossover vehicle that's been launched already in Europe, build it in China and bring it back in the United States. And they make a decision to stop that mm-hmm. and say, we're not going to do it because it's not going to be profitable. That becomes real, I think, to people. It becomes real when General Motors asks for an exemption for its Buick Envision SUV because it's built in China as well, and I would be willing to bet you they're not going to get that exemption.
So explain for me then when you're talking about these kind of big picture auto industry issues right now because of the economy, like how does that affect me? Like I know this sounds silly, but like make me care that this is all happening right now.
Well, I think ultimately it will affect you in terms of prices. I think you're going to start to see, and it's anecdotal right now, but you're going to start to see businesses that are struggling. There are suppliers that are sourcing product in China or they're sourcing metals that they then turn into parts. The prices of those goods are affected by the tariffs. Yeah, I mean, this economy, I mean, the argument for the people who support tariffs is that the economy is robust enough and large enough that it can absorb a lot of this stuff. And to some extent, it probably can. Mm-hmm.
But I think in the case of the autos, you ask, okay, if these companies become less profitable and you work for one of them in a plant somewhere and they make less money in the United States, that means your profit sharing checks, which have been hitting record levels, are going to go down next year and the year after that. That's what that means. It means that your company is less profitable, and your company is less profitable, it invests less. I think that's the other question. Do they defer investments? You have less profits. Do you hire less?
Right.
Those are all kind of intangibles. When you start to put that thing in the soup, it becomes an issue. I don't think there's any question about what this trade war is going to be or is a headwind on the economy. The question is, how stiff of a headwind is it?
And then, of course, you write about your concerns about just sort of the intertwiningness of tariffs and politics and how they can't be unentwined at this point. They can't be broken apart, it feels like, in some ways.
No, and I think what President Trump is doing is politicizing the economy in so many ways. He's complained.
Well, it is the economy, stupid.
Yes, exactly. But I mean, he's complained publicly about decisions that the Fed is taking. I mean, people need to be reminded, we've had almost 10 years of free money. Interest rates were at zero or close to it. And so the Fed is starting to raise interest rates because its job is price stability and to maximize employment. That's its job. And it's supposed to be independent and it's supposed to make call balls and strikes. And the president doesn't seem to like that when all of a sudden he's doing what he calls a lot of the work on the economy, and the Fed turns around and raises rates. So you have a Fed governor who comes in to talk at the Detroit Economic Club this week, and she doesn't want to wade into these political things. Mm-hmm. And I can understand why, because if you wade into these political things, you've got a president who wields social media like an electronic scythe. Mm-hmm. I mean, he'll go after anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing it again this morning from what I have read already.
Daniel Howes, columnist at the Detroit News. He joins us most Thursdays on Stateside. Dan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It was a moment of pure joy for the Detroit Tigers 50 years ago, beating the St. Louis Cardinals to win the 1968 World Series, the first championship for Detroit since 1945. As the team popped champagne corks in their locker room at Busch Stadium, legendary Tigers broadcaster George Kell spoke with team owner John Fetzer.
I'm sorry to be inflicted on you fellas a second time around, but they just had me in the whirlpool.
I saw him, Kerry.
The whirlpool is almost as good as the champagne. It's very, very good. The boys paid me a great compliment by picking me up and throwing me in, and I appreciate it a lot.
Professor, we've had a lot of them up here tonight, and nearly every one of them said they wanted to win it for you and Jim Campbell. That's quite a compliment.
Well, I tell you, as far as I'm concerned, they're all my boys. I saw them grow up from just kids into men. And there is no greater satisfaction in this world than seeing a man become a man. And that's what our boys did tonight.
You brought them from Tiger Town to Tiger Stadium.
Right.
Good luck to you.
Fetzer owned the Detroit Tigers from 1961 until 1983. He left his mark on Michigan in many other ways, as you're about to hear. And he was deeply spiritual. He spent his life exploring new ways of thinking, new spiritual movements, and expanding his worldview. That story is told by author Brian C. Wilson in his new book, John E. Fetzer and the Quest for the New Age. Brian Wilson is a professor of American religious history at Western Michigan University. He recently spoke with Cindy.
So beyond these broad strokes, tell us just who was John Fetzer?
Well, he was many people, actually. Once upon a time, he said that if they ever wrote about him, they would have to call the book The Nine Lives of John Fetzer. And the reason for this is, on the one hand, he was a hard-headed businessman who basically parlayed a small radio station, WKZO here in Kalamazoo, into a kind of regional media empire that included television and cable and music. And he also was the owner of the Detroit Tigers for years. So he made millions in business, and he was a very, very successful businessman. But the reason I'm interested in him as a professor of comparative religion is that he was also on a lifelong spiritual search that took him into all sorts of interesting metaphysical traditions. And over a lifetime, he basically crafted his own spiritual worldview.
So this is, you were certainly drawn to this enough to the point where you felt it was book worthy.
Yes, and the fact that the Fetzer Institute houses a very extensive archive of John Fetzer's papers and letters and other memorabilia. So for me, what I really enjoy doing is reconstructing the way people put together their either religious or spiritual worldviews. My last book was on Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, and it was called Dr. John Harvey Kellogg and the Religion of Biologic Living. And it was also the same situation because he had an extensive documentation. So I could actually see and work through the years as he basically created his worldview and as it evolved. And the same thing with John Fetzer, who also wasn't a professional theologian or anything like that, and yet intensely interested in spiritual topics. And in fact, so interested that near the end of his life, he basically liquidated all his business assets and used the money as an endowment for a foundation to basically promote and preserve his spiritual interests. And that's the Fetzer Institute.
So here we are. We're talking about a man who was born in 1901 and died in 1991. So his life basically spanned the 20th century. So the question is, I know he was, from your book, he was baptized into the local Methodist Episcopal Church. So take us through how he went from being a small-town Midwestern Methodist to what became this lifelong exploration of metaphysical religions and movements.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story because, as you mentioned, he was baptized a Methodist and had a very kind of conventional Christian upbringing. And then when he was a teenager, his mother converted to Seventh-day Adventism. And so he followed his mother into the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which, of course, is an apocalyptic group that has its roots here in Michigan. And he was a committed Seventh-day Adventist for years, and it gave him some really wonderful opportunities in terms of education and learning the radio trade. But in his late 20s, he really found it was kind of spiritually limiting for him. And so he left the church. And at that point, one of the things he did is he headed south to Indiana and went to a place called Camp Chesterfield, which is one of the oldest spiritualist communities, spiritualist camps left in the United States. It's still in business.
And let me stop you there. What does spiritualist mean?
Well, spiritualism is a 19th century tradition that basically believes in the survival of personality after death, and that there are special people called mediums who can basically contact the spirits of the dead, both for comfort but also for enlightenment as well.
Which certainly shows us how that dovetailed into his interest as he went through his life in parapsychology, UFOs, and more, right?
That's correct. Yeah, spiritualism was just the start. Camp Chesterfield has a wonderful bookstore, a metaphysical bookstore, that basically deals in all sorts of different traditions. So Fetzer said that every time he went down there, he would come back with an armload of books. And so he started studying things like theosophy and Hermeticism and Rosicrucianism, and he became a Freemason. And then later in life, he got very interested in channeling and such things as A Course in Miracles, which is a famous channeled text, and the Urantia Book, another channeled text.
And, you know, as you list some of those, they're terms, Freemasonry, theosophy, mm-hmm. A lot of us have heard them. Maybe we don't know what they mean. So where did that take him? What were the beliefs of these types of systems?
Well, probably theosophy was the most influential, and that's another 19th century new religious movement from the United States that basically tried to combine Western esotericism with Hinduism and Buddhism. So out of this, for example, he got a very strong belief in reincarnation and the power of karma. And for the rest of his life, he was fascinated with past life experiences and the whole idea of reincarnation. So that was just one of many of metaphysical ideas. And of course, metaphysical just simply refers to a group of traditions that see the universe as is just one thing, as monistic. and wholly made up of spirit, circulating spirit.
As he spent this life of his on this spiritual quest with this spiritual restlessness, and he was really looking to expand his understanding of the spiritual life and his worldview, how was that reflected in the way he did business?
Well, it's interesting because he was very good at compartmentalizing his business from his spiritual quest.
So you're saying he could be a very hard-nosed businessman. It didn't make him soft and mushy.
No. I think he was always a very fair person and a good person to his employees. But he also didn't impose his spiritual beliefs on his businesses. And part of this was practical because I think he was concerned that in Southwest Michigan, which tends to be pretty conservative religiously, that if people knew he was studying all this metaphysical stuff, he'd lose audience members and advertisers. So he was very cautious about it. And it's interesting because a lot of his longtime colleagues in his businesses knew he was interested in this, but had no idea just how far it went.
And how did this quest of John Fetzer's match or track with the quest many people were on through the 20th century? I mean, just thinking of his lifespan.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the interesting things I found in doing this book is that metaphysical thinking was prominent in the Midwest throughout the 20th century. So John Fetzer really didn't have to go too far. In fact, it all started just a day's drive south of us in Camp Chesterfield. So there were many Americans who, during this period, were also looking for kind of spiritual alternatives to the traditions they had been born into. And so one of the things the book tries to do is kind of chart the rise of this kind of metaphysical thinking through the 20th century and show how John Fetzer was really part of a larger kind of movement that eventually culminated in the New Age. And I think that the thing is, he identified himself as a New Ager as early as the 1960s. And the term only really became popular in the United States in the 1980s and 90s. And now most people who are into metaphysical things would hate to be labeled a New Ager simply because it kind of denotes a very kind of hyper-individualistic and narcissistic spirituality. And that definitely was not what John Fetzer was looking for.
And the Fetzer Institute that he founded continues to this day. What does it do in Michigan? What has its effect been?
Well, the Fetzer Institute is basically designed to promote spirituality in various forms. The key here is he always thought that individual spiritual transformation was important, not simply in and of itself, but that if you got enough people who were spiritually transformed, it would ultimately catalyze the spiritual transformation of the world. And so the Fetzer Institute is really, I mean, one of its goals is through individual spiritual transformation to basically promote this, hopefully catalyze this global spiritual transformation. And it does this, it's an operating foundation. So it basically underwrites research and a variety of different programs to that end. And so, for example, today, the Institute is funding programs that basically promote spirituality of all kinds throughout the life cycle, from childhood to old age. And another recent project is very interesting. It's basically looking at the spiritual roots of democracy. Many at the Institute are concerned about where the country is today politically and just how divided it is. And so the idea is for people of a variety of different political stripes to come together and think about the values and kind of spiritual foundation of democracy as a way of getting people to talk to each other instead of shouting at each other.
And actually, I wanted to ask you, since you have, in researching your book, John E. Fetzer and the Quest for the New Age, Brian Wilson, you've been living inside this man's head and inside his heart. What do you think John Fetzer would make of the business and political and spiritual climate of our country in 2018?
Well, on the one hand, I think he'd be immensely excited about the advances in technology, because he started back when radio was just a primitive, very primitive kind of technology. So I think he would be absolutely fascinated by computers and the internet and things like that. But on the other hand, I think he'd be very concerned about kind of the spiritual climate, the kind of tensions and divisions in the country today. And so I think he was always very optimistic. So I think he would think wherever we are, we can always work through these problems. But for him, it always began with a recognition of kind of the spiritual basis of things.
Brian Wilson is a professor of American religious history in the Department of Comparative Religion at Western Michigan University. His new book is John E. Fetzer and the Quest for the New Age. Brian C. Wilson, pleasure talking with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Wilson has book events coming up in both Kalamazoo and Petoskey. You can find a link with more information at michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, April Van Buren, Sam Corey, Joey Horan, and Sarah Leeson. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Zoe Clark, in today for Cindy Canty. Thanks so much for listening.